Welcome to the Cyan and Rican podcast. I am Cyan of Flame.
And I'm Throwhead Rican.
Today we're going to be talking about the best fights in all of anime. Shonen mangas and animes are based pretty much entirely around the fights. It's like you're waiting for that big payoff moment. There's some great storyline, there's some great endeavors, but it doesn't matter what kind of fight, whether they're in a robot, if they're doing fist to fist, if they're doing ninjutsu, they're using magic, if they're cooking, it's all about the fights.
Especially cooking.
I've seen some cooking mangas and cooking animes where, like, I'm pretty jazzed up when it goes down. Like
Toriko, I remember when I first heard about Toriko, and we talked about it in the Shonen anime podcast. Toriko's kind of strange how it starts, and, you know, they're like, oh, this is a cooking show, manga, you know, whatever, and suddenly it's like Dragon Ball fights. Like, for no reason. But it still involves cooking. Like, they still involve cooking technique, cooking ingredients, and stuff like that within the context of the fights, which is very strange.
Yeah, they even had that in Hunter x Hunter. They had...
I just started watching
gourmet,
it, actually.
They had the gourmet hunters. Mm-hmm. So they hunted different types of food and had to prepare it in, like, the perfect ways as a part of the hunter exam. So there's a lot of different ones. There's Food Wars, Shogeki no Soma, is an entire manga that just got an anime.
Nice.
And it's purely about cooking. There's no magic or like super monsters or anything. It's just like, okay, I'm going to make the best meal I possibly can. Fried eggs and rice. And wait, what? Fried rice? That's it and everything. But like they go into this detail about how it's like the most magical fried rice of all time.
Anime is just strange like that.
Everything. So
they can make the most mundane thing just seem amazing.
If you tell it with flair and some cool art and you have fun with it, you can make a fight scene out of whatever you would like.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what anime does best. We held ourselves to a little bit of one rule, and that was that we wanted to have only one fight per anime. So that way the list wasn't dominated with 10 straight fights of Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, we pretty much before we manufactured this list and decided, okay, we're going to go with these 10. We had probably, what, 5 fights that we were like, these are all Dragon Ball fights, and we wanted to put them at least in, like, the top 5. So we had to control that. But basically, it basically speaks of the quality of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z as far as like the fight scenes, both in the manga and in animation, how good they were, and how all these other shows that came after and manga basically took a little bit of that. You know, like there's an imprint of Dragon Ball still left in Shonen. Like you see it in Naruto, you see it in Bleach, you see it, you definitely see it in One Piece. So a lot of the stuff that Toriyama did is still resonating.
So absolutely.
We had to control the ones
are just the Dragon Ball of food, the Dragon Ball of pirates, the Dragon right. Ball of ninjas and stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. Like that's kind of how a lot of shows, I tend to describe a lot of shows, like One Piece, I tell people, it's like, remember Dragon Ball Z? Okay, put pirates in it. Like that's, and they have an idea of where I'm going with that, like that the fights are going to be insane and, you know, the power levels are going to be just ridiculous. And most people wind up giving it a try and liking it. I remember I met a couple of people that swore that Naruto was the best anime they've ever seen, and I told them about One Piece, and now they've dropped Naruto, even though Naruto just ended recently, but they've dropped it altogether to watch One Piece. So.
Yeah. Another funny thing about our list, our favorite characters aren't always necessarily the main character, the face of the show. Like, Naruto may not be your favorite guy in Naruto. Luffy may not be your favorite guy in One Piece. Goku may not be your favorite guy in Dragon Ball Z. But it's kind of funny. Most of our list has the main character, the marquee guy of the show and everything. And it just kind of shows that, you know, kind of like John Cena. John Cena's got most of the best matches in the WWE and everything because he's the main guy. Like, it's
right.
all that kind of drama built up for it. You're
gonna
the
story, the
fight.
Story, there's a lot of story. Like, the more background you have to a fight, I think the more impressive, like, it leaves an imprint on you more than a fight between two random people that had no reason to fight.
not necessarily even that they have no reason and everything, but like even if they have a story, it's that kind of like smaller story, whereas some of the like big ones have like so many moments and so much time given to it, you've been waiting for it for so long, and right. that pays off perfectly. I think we're ready to kick into this list.
Yeah, boy.
Right. So number 10, Neutra versus Kenpachi. Bleach.
From Bleach, yes. Now, do you remember, did you read or did you watch this fight?
I read it originally, and mm-hmm. when you were talking about it, I decided to watch it in the anime because you mentioned it as one of your favorite fights in Bleach, or your right. favorite fight in Bleach. And so I hadn't read it in a couple of years, so I was like, okay, I'm going to watch it in the anime because I haven't really watched the anime for Bleach as much. I kind of dropped off when they ended the Soul Society arc.
Right.
Because there was just too much filler.
Yeah, absolutely too much filler.
Yeah. And so I was like, I think that was a really short fight.
It was.
Like, maybe they added a lot in the anime.
Nope.
And nope, it was pretty much what I remembered. So I was a little caught off guard, but watching it, I was like, God, that was badass, though.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's where I'm going with this. So sometimes the best fights aren't necessarily the longest ones or the most drawn-out ones. Sometimes the simplest thing and even the dumbest thing just makes it more badass. Like, the reason why I like Neutra and Kenpachi so much from Bleach, I mean, there's other fights. Like, I can think of, you know, Ichigo versus Grimmjow, Ichigo versus Kenpachi, Chad versus... whatever was the Espada that he fought, that was actually a decent fight. There's a lot of good fights. The only reason why this one stuck with me was because, A, when Neutra came out as the Espada that he came out, and he, I believe he went through about four people that he fought, one of them being Chad. Chad came out of his fight, and you're like, oh, he got a power level. You know, he might be able to at least try to fend off the Espada.
Like, as soon as he beat his Espada, like, Neutra came in and just KO'd him like a
man. Yeah, yeah, one hit. So you're like, oh my god, this guy is a monster. And then you had Nell try to fight him. Ichigo, I think, had a swing at him. I'm pretty sure
what
Ichigo
was. Ichigo had just beaten Grimmjow.
Oh, that's right.
And,
so he was.
And so like he was completely just done. Like he barely
yeah,
beat
so,
Grimmjow.
So he couldn't. Yeah, he was.
So it wasn't really a fight, but like Neutra jumped in and attacked Ichigo while he was weak, and that's why Nell came in and revealed that she had been a former Espada.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, we had that moment, and everyone was trying to fend him off, and then Kenpachi comes out of nowhere, and you're like, oh, Kenpachi, and Kenpachi initially has a little trouble with him, you know, because, again, Neutra is described as the strongest, as far as, like, pure strength, pure raw strength, Neutra is apparently one of the strongest Espadas.
He has the hardest skin.
Yeah, the heart is, what did they call their skin? I know it was a Spanish word. Yeho. He had the Spanish, yeah, Yeho, which translates to steel. So he had the strongest steel, let's go with that, skin. So no one could, you know, quote unquote penetrate him, you know, cut him. Kenpachi decides, oh, I'm gonna go in there and I'm gonna try this technique. And everyone's thinking, oh, there's gonna be a great power up. You know, he's gonna do something amazing. Maybe he's gonna take off the eye patch.
Man made me practice kendo.
Yeah, the old man made me practice kendo, which basically means I'm gonna hold the sword with two hands instead of one. Cause Kenpachi was pretty much like a lackadaisical with his sword skills. He would just use one hand. And he strikes with both hands with all of his might, and he one-hit KOs Neutra, which, again, is just such a badass moment in the Bleach manga. Because for, I don't know how many chapters it was, or how many episodes in the anime, but Neutra seemed indestructible for a while there when he was introduced. And to see him just get one-hit KO'd was great.
Yeah, Kenpachi does what Kenpachi does, and rolls in ferociously.
Just rolls in. So I think out of all the fights, yeah, Grimmjow versus Ichigo, it's a great fight. So is Ulquiorra versus Ichigo. But they're drawn out fights. Like, I like certain things to be drawn out, but there's some fights that can go on for too long. Same with the Dr. Espada, I forgot his name.
God, that fight went so long.
That fight,
Vaporo?
Yeah, Zaziel. Like, all I remember from him was that his release was Fornicarás, and I was like, really? Like, your release name is To Fornicate? Cool. So that one, and I remember that one went on for, God, that went for like a year, 2 years, that fight in the manga. The anime was like, you know, 20, 30 episodes. It was long. It was ridiculously long.
Yeah, because Kubo, like, jumps back and forth between like four fights that he's gotten all at once and everything. So it dragged out a really, really long time.
Yeah, that fight was way too long. Like, everyone was done with their fights and they were still fighting that fool. So for me, the Noi Travelers vs. Kenpachi was like the purest, you know, fight, I guess. And just the moment and the way it was animated and, you know, with the music and Noitra having the flashback. It was just great. I liked it enough to put it at least in the top 10.
And it deserves to be in the top 10. Number 9, a different kind of sword fight, rather than curved swords and a guy just choosing to do two hands. This is the two greatest Hitokiris, the two greatest murderers of the Bakumatsu Revolution. We're talking about Rurouni Kenshin. We're talking about Kenshin Himura facing Makoto Shishio.
Makoto Shishio. Oh, from Rurouni Kenshin.
This fight had been built up across the entire Kyoto arc, which is the longest arc in Kenshin, ranging from volume 7 to 17, over 10 volumes of pure stuff talking purely about Shishio.
Yeah, there was a lot of hype.
All of the 10 swords, all of the 10 swords get up there. He had just beaten Sojiro, and he comes in and he faces Shishio, and this fight has so much on the line. Like, pretty much, if Kenshin can't beat Shishio, Shishio will conquer Japan, is the way they're selling this.
Yeah, it seemed like, I mean, I remember when I watched this, and I watched this, I think I was fairly young, I was 14, 15 when I first saw this fight. Like, first time I saw it without reading it, without having any context, like, I was watching the show, and suddenly this fight happens. And two things I remember about this fight. One, again, the stakes being very, very high for an animated show. Like, both in terms of what's going to happen to the main character. Like, your main character can die, so that's already, like, a big risk. But if he dies, Japan, a whole country, falls under the villain. Like, that was pretty big stakes for something for me to be watching something of that age. Because a lot of these shonen shows, or any show in general, like, if the villain wins, oh, the planet, you know, they can take over the planet. Which is kind of like a weird thing to think about, like, one person holding an entire planet hostage. But politically, one person can hold a country. So this seemed like a very real threat to me.
Especially since they'd gone into a lot of detail. For me at least, Watsuki, who wrote Kenshin, he hasn't really been able to connect on anything else but Kenshin. That's kind of why he went back and redid a new Kenshin story lately.
Yeah.
But the detail that he put into it, like, he put a lot of care and passion into it, not just researching to make sure that, like, you know, things were time accurate for that era and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But there was a lot of detail. It wasn't just like, oh, Shishio's got this huge army and he's gonna, you know, march it in and take over and everything, like some sort of like standard thing. No, like, it flat out was like Shishio bought a battleship and everything and was gonna recreate, you know, the terror that people felt when they saw a battleship when Matthew Perry came in. Or Shishio has, you know, spies in different organizations and, you know, they're buying off things so that he can have a higher place in society. Or,
yeah, like, what, there was like a political, there was a political side to, like,
different sides that he had, like, and any one of these plans could have led him to it, but he had all of them going because he had, I think Hoji was his name.
Hoji was his kind of like his manservant, his advisor.
Yeah, his brain, like.
Yeah, and yeah, he was like the political, he was kind of like the Grimjaw, or not Grimjaw, it's the character from Lord of the Rings, Grimtongue. He was kind of like his Grimtongue, like he just had his eyes and ears everywhere. And I just remember, again, watching this as a 15-year-old, like, it left an impression. Like, I'm sitting there like, oh my god, this is a legit threat for the main character. And before that, I don't think there was any other villain type in the show. In the story that seemed that threatening. Even the Oniwabanchu leader that he fought didn't seem like he didn't have
Aoshi.
Yeah, like he didn't have like these these delusions of grandeur, and, you know, they didn't have these plans of taking over the government, taking over a whole country. Like, there was none of that, and he was nowhere near as threatening.
Yeah,
and I remember
every other villain you had, like, starting off, you had the first villain was Sanosuke, and Sanosuke, you know, obviously he just wanted to fight, and he was mad against kind of the revolution and stuff because they murdered his friends. So, you know, he had some good in him. He ended up becoming a hero. Aoshi with the Oniwabanshu.
Yeah.
Same exact deal and everything. He ended up becoming one of the heroes. He helps out a lot later on in the series. Saito, you know, he was his biggest enemy in the revolution with the Shinsengumi. But what happens? He became one of the heroes.
Yeah, and again, like, all these villains, like, just did not have... again, I think it was really the political thing that got to me as a kid. Like, this guy will take over your entire, like, your world, your story world is going to be taken over by him, which I think is the most threatening thing that can happen. And not only that, I think it was also the moment, I think I mentioned to you when I picked this, I was like, this is the moment that really got me during this fight, was when Shishio bit Kenshin. I mean, when he bit him in the neck, he grabs him, pulls him close, because you think, oh, Kenshin might have a chance, you know, blah, blah. And Shishio just bites his neck like a deranged vampire man, and you're thinking, oh my god, he's going to do anything in his power to beat Kenshin, including resorting to basically cannibalism.
Yeah, Shishio didn't just bite him. Like, Shishio looks like a mummy because of his wraps and everything. He pulls his mouth wide open
and takes a chunk
takes out a chunk of his entire area right next to his shoulder and neck and everything.
Yeah.
And bites in viciously, like, and Kenshin sold it like it was holy death. Like, he's falling back, you know, burned down and everything. I know I said sold it, sorry.
he no sold that shoulder bite.
Like, he didn't no sold that shoulder bite. He went down. For me, the biggest moment was when Kenshin's about to strike him down finally, and he hasn't beaten, and he's stalls for a second because Shishio's lover throws herself in the way.
Yeah,
and Shishio immediately stabs right through his girlfriend's and stabs Kenshin
basically
through
her
his liver.
Yeah.
Like, steps through her and gets Kenshin kind of in the side.
Yeah,
and Kenshin goes down, and you know, like, Kenshin's beaten. Like, there's no way Kenshin can go on after this.
Right,
and you get that big moment and everything where, you know, Shishio was her life, and she'll die so that Shishio can be king. She's fine with that. Like, that's actually what she wants.
Yeah, and I think another part of that fight was also the I don't remember if they had established that he could do this, but another moment was when he started basically flinging fire at Kenshin with his sword. He would he had a technique where he would do slashes and use, I think he was using oil or something. There was something he was using. I can't remember at the moment.
I remember what it was, and it was actually the thing that made me think about this fight and how gruesome. Shishio is. So Shishio's sword is kind of the sister sword to Kenshin's Sakabato reverse blade sword.
Right.
They were both made by the same sword master, and for the exact opposite purpose.
Right, like one was dull.
Was the sword of life. It was made to protect and not to kill.
So
Shishio's sword was the sword made to kill. It was purely made that it would never dull, it would never stop chipping, and it would only get stronger the more people it killed.
Soul
because
edge.
it was born with an imperfection and everything because it was chipped. And so because of this chipping, when it would cut people down, human fat would fill
divots
of the sword.
That's
and
right.
So the human fat is what is igniting.
Yeah, that was
and so every time he cuts you, he's able to get more fuel for his flame in there. And that's just sadistically disgusting. Like,
yeah. I remember everything about Shishio was just like, it was just horrifying.
Shishio,
like, as a villain.
A bad dude. Like, even when you have that flashback to when Sojiro met him, because he was hiding out in Sojiro's family's barn, basically. Mm-hmm. Sojiro discovers him, and there's another guy in front of him. Shishio cuts this guy, slashes down from the top of his head right through his crotch, like just cuts the man in half top to bottom. So like you already know, like weakened Shishio can cut a man in half in one strike.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, I know is that Shishio doesn't get the proper respect, I think, as a villain. Like if we ever do a list of villains, I think Shishio should be in like the top five. Cause he is pure, just absolute evil. And his fight with Kenshin was, I think, the highlight of the entire, like, out of all the fights that are in Rurouni Kenshin, I'm pretty sure, to me, it's the best fight.
Not only that, it was only the second time that we saw the final technique of Kenshin's sword style.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But it was the only time that we saw the true nature of it, the final form of why it's inescapable when you're facing the Amakakaru Ryo no Hiramaki. He does the slash, and we actually see that Shishio is able to, you know, hold past the strike, but the force of that step when he unleashes his move actually creates what's basically a black hole.
So you get sucked into the move.
Even if you miss, it sucks him in, and he hits another shot and is able to, like, put Shishio back. And still Shishio didn't lose. I mean, this is coming after Shishio had beaten Saito. Saito landed his big thrust attack right in his head.
And, yeah, nothing happened.
Nothing happened because Shishio had been shot in the head before, so he wore that, like, metal plate in his head.
Yep.
So, like, he'd beaten Saito. Like you kind of think of it in that way of, like, well, Kenshin wasn't fresh. Like, Kenshin had gone through, like, this gauntlet.
Shishio kind of went through
a gauntlet, too. Like,
they were both pretty busy. Yeah, they were pretty busy, you know, doing, kind of having pre-fights, so to speak, before they got here. And, you know, with all the planning that Shishio was doing, like, I'm pretty sure a mental exhaustion was also probably here at work. But they were evenly matched. And
well, I mean, mental and physical exhaustion, because Shishio fights with a time limit. And
oh, that's right. That's
the only reason that Shishio did not win was Shishio burst into flame at the end of the fight because his body had been burned so badly that he's not able to sweat, basically.
Right.
So his internal temperature built up to where he ended up just burning from the inside out and died. Yeah,
basically combusted.
And I think it would be unfair to move on from Shishio without recognizing that when he died and went to hell, this is a point where it went a little ridiculous. He didn't just go to hell and be all like, all right, he's another spirit in hell. He decided...
He's going to take over.
Well, I'm in hell... I might as well be king of hell.
Yeah. and again, like, it's one of the things where you're like, maybe he can. Because he only lost to Shishio or to Kenshin because, like you said, he had, like, a time limit. Like, his body gave up. Mm-hmm. Like, he probably could have beaten Kenshin.
That was the thing I always wanted to see a little bit more of because I thought Shishio, you saw him in silhouette at points when before he had been set on fire. He had that long-haired. He looked a lot like Musashi from Soul Calibur.
Yeah. They never did show him everything.
So fully healed, huh?
I
always kind of wanted to see him, like, when he was, like, at his absolute healthy best and everything. Just how terrifying of a guy he was that they had to, you know, sneak shot him and set him on fire.
Right.
But he was just such a cool character. And so much about him. And it was... you know, the top fight of the series.
Oh, yeah. I think no matter what they show, like, I think showing him before he became that, you know, the mummy, basically, the mummy samurai, would disenchant, like, how terrifying he is. It'd be kind of like what they did with Vader, you know, in Star Wars, like, when they showed him as a kid and as a teenager, and you're like, oh, he's kind of a snot. You know, snot-nosed kid, you know, who's basically just angry at the world because he can't have a girlfriend.
He wasn't angry yet. He was afraid.
Yeah.
And you know, fear turns to anger.
anger
and
leads
anger
to hate.
Turns to hate. And hate,
leads, to
hate leads to the dark side. All right.
Nice.
So,
very nice.
For more on that.
Anything else, Master
Yoda?
Last
episode. Number eight. So
number eight.
Gundam is a huge series. It's been running in Japan for decades in different incarnations. The Gundam franchise is Mecha. Like, let's face it. Mecha
yeah.
is Gundam.
Without Gundam, there's no Transformers. There's no Evangelion. There's no Mecha at all. Like, Gundam is Mecha.
Yeah. Gundam is also interesting because it's one of the few franchises that's a new series that's always told originally in anime.
Yes.
These aren't based on manga. There are mangas for, you know, Gundam Wing. There are mangas for Gundam 00 and other franchises, but
they come after the fact.
They come after the fact. They're follow-up series and everything. So when you watch a Gundam anime, you're getting the intended series right off the bat. And unquestionably the most well-known Gundam series in the West is Gundam Wing.
Right.
It's the one that we kind of got first and had, like, the loud main characters and everything, cool designs, lots of stuff,
yeah.
everything. And
it also came at the height of anime in the U.S., like, during that time in the 90s.
Gundam Wing's kind of spiritual successor, where you got those five things, but, like, in a brand new animation coding with a bit of a better realized storyline behind it, was Gundam 00. And Gundam 00, its best, like, coolest fight, in my opinion, is Setsuna FCA piloting the Exia Gundam at the end of Season 1 against Alejandro Corner in the Alvaron Gundam.
Alejandro.
Alejandro.
I love that. That is such a heel name.
Alejandro Corner.
I don't know why, but that name, Setsuna, sounds like a good guy. Alejandro Corner, as soon as I hear that name, I know that's a villain.
Dude, even his robot, even his Gundam,
yeah.
the Alvaron.
Yeah, Alvaron, yeah.
They're all like, oof, I don't know what the Alvaron's going to do. But I mean, you just see the design and everything. It comes out, it's this giant golden angel. Like, I don't know about you, and maybe it's like the eternal pessimist in me, but as soon as I see a gigantic golden angel, I think, well, that thing's evil. It's kind of
like how Evangelion, you know, would name all the monsters angels, like the angels are the bad guys, and you're like, yeah, okay, I can dig it.
No, with this one, it's just like when something tries too hard to look angelic, it makes me think like it's got to be evil. I don't trust that thing.
Yeah,
and it's
just a
cool ship. Like, it comes in and it's wrecking against the Exia and everything. And the Exia is piloted by Setsuna, like their strongest pilot. They're going against each other, and there's this moment where like he seems like he's almost going to be beaten, but Alejandro doesn't have the heart of a Gundam pilot, kind of. And so Setsuna initiates Trans Am, which is kind of like the Kaioken of a Gundam and everything. It turns like solid red. It starts moving incredibly fast, and he just starts destroying him back and forth and uses the seven sword system. And you just see him like, there's this moment where Alejandro's like, but I'm piloting the best machine. Like, how could I lose to this guy? And he gets called up by Ribbons, who's been playing him, and is like, yeah, I knew you were going to lose because you didn't have, like, the heart, even in that cool machine. And the entire time you're just watching, and he, like, slowly in his eyes is realizing, like, I'm going to blow up in this machine and die. As Setsuna is just stabbing seven separate swords into his Gundam, and then watches it blow up. And the best thing about it is, like, you get this cool fight. The fight goes about, you know, 5-6 minutes. And it's a really well-animated, really vicious fight. And then right after that is when Grant comes in as, like, the true rival, chops off Exia's arm. Then Exia chops off the arm of his flag, and they start having a fight, and the series just ends.
Yeah, like,
They're
like
fighting.
It's over.
There's gonna be a follow-up fight after this cool thing, and you never really know the outcome of their battle, except for like a little bit followed up in season two. Like, okay, the Exia is jacked up; it only has one arm. They barely survived. But you just had this awesome fight, and then it's followed up with, like, oh, God, like, that's the fight I wanted to see.
And then cliffhanger.
And end and everything. Yeah. And it's just so masterfully done that it just leaves you watching, wanting more.
Yeah, watch this fight, because I've never been really big on Gundam, other than the only Gundam I liked, and I didn't really care for it as much, was Gundam Wing. And I've always tried giving it another Gundam series a try, and once in a while I'll see a fight or two that I like. This one, after you told me, you're like, oh, you know, this is the fight I want to put in the list. And I saw the fight, and like you said, it's a really good fight, and then when the ending comes, you're like, wait, like, now what? Like, are we done? Like, is it over? And I had to look around, and, you know, people were like, oh, you know, this is what happens. And I was kind of left there like, I want more of that. Like, I want that to be animated. Like, I don't care who it is that we have to pay, but I kind of want to see that fight animated, or at least told in flashback if it hasn't been told already. Just to get a follow-up of sorts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there are more moments that are everything. You get more follow-up when the Exia and the O Gundam are combined to create the Double O and everything, mm-hmm. which I thought was a really bold strategy, that Gundam Double O, you don't see the Double O Gundam until halfway through the second series.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the meaning of the Double O, because that's what I had read, that it doesn't come out till way later.
Yeah, because Exia Gundam is like kind of like Gundam number one of Celestial Being, mm-hmm. and the prototype was the O Gundam, the Zero Gundam, and they're combined in the twin system to create the Double O Gundam. There's actually a really great moment where Setsuna, like, they've done all the tests, and they've put everything together perfectly. There's no way the Double O Gundam will work, having these two Gundams combined. And they're all like, there's no way it'll work. You'd need at least three Gundams to make this work, and there's no way to make another Gundam. We're out of Gundanium. And and Setsuna is a little insane. Setsuna has been, like, trained as a child soldier. Basically, they kind of had it that he was kind of like one of, like, the Taliban children, almost. Like,
right.
Like, led by a terrorist organization and everything, like, driven, conditioned to be nothing but a warrior and everything, and he slowly, like, wakes up from that and moves away from it. He's also a little insane in the fact that he thinks he, personally, is a Gundam. So, he just has this overdrive as he's standing inside of the Gundam, and he's like, there are three Gundams here. There's the Exia, the O, and me. And he drives it forward, and he's able to jumpstart it, and he gets the Double O Gundam to finally work. And at that moment, you're like, well, nothing's going to stop this guy. Like, he's going to kill everything in the world.
Yeah. Like, well, now what?
And I mean, we've already seen in, like, various series that, like, a Gundam unleashed is a terror machine. Like,
it
can beat an army by itself.
Like, right. Which is why, you know, they want these pilots, you know, to be, like, these people that they can trust, you know, people that they want to put in these machines. Like, they go through all this rigorous, like, trying to figure out who should be driving the Gundam, you know, because otherwise, a madman with a Gundam, Alejandro, could be a really bad thing.
Yeah, and you kind of see that a little bit in various series. You always get the guy who's, you know, not qualified, and he's either, like, killed by the machine itself, or like from not being able to handle it, kind of like Alejandro was.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just driven insane. Like, one of the Gundams in Gundam Wing would literally drive you insane if you piloted it and weren't ready.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty crazy the way that they have it built up. But
it kind of reminds me of what they did with Pacific Rim, where Pacific Rim, you know, you have to do the mind link. So, like,
oh,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, to be a good pilot, you know, you had to have a good link with your partner. So it wasn't so much the machine that you had to be linked with, but you had to have complete trust in a partner. So if, you know, if you had, like, one person that was, let's say, like, an Alejandro, right, trying to link with Setsuna, like, it wouldn't work, because Alejandro was fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, very true, very true. Now for the next one is all about that fighting spirit. It's all about focus. It's all about training and determination, punching through. It's Ippo, Makenouchi Ippo versus Sendo.
And number seven.
My fight that I picked for this one isn't the more well-known title fight that they have at the end of the first series, mm-hmm. Where it has like the which is an amazing fight still, and you have that big moment where he delivers, you know, gazelle punch, liver blow, Dempsey yeah. roll, like the big three hit combination,
right, the final combo,
and takes him out and everything, and that moment's absolutely insane and incredible, but I'm actually always been enamored with their first fight, the first time they ever meet in the Rookie King Championship. They were both, you know, still in their first year. They went through this huge thing, and you didn't even know if Ippo was going to be able to fight at all. Ippo broke his fist fighting against Mashiba, because Mashiba yeah. would do the dirty blows and hit him yeah. with his elbow.
Mashiba was Mashiba the one that did the whip punch?
Yeah, he would okay. do the hangman style flicker yeah. jabs.
Yeah, the flicker, yeah. there you go, flicker jabs.
Yeah. And so Mashiba, like, is still a major character, Sendo's still a major character, and everything. So you had this whole fallout, and you kind of get to see, like, oh, wow, Sendo is really, he's just like Ippo,
mm-hmm.
but he's from the other side of the country and everything. Cause like he first comes in, he introduces himself. He's like, oh, I've been watching your fights. Like you're just like me. You're a real man. You get in there and you throw it out in the middle of the ring as an infighter and everything. Like,
yeah,
like we're so much alike and we both throw these sharp punches and everything. We're the two toughest guys and everything. And then like, you're all like, oh, this guy's, you know, he's a good guy. He's Ippo's friend. He's just like Ippo. Like what a cool matchup and everything like that. And then he gets into the ring, for like a little spar session with Takamura, and turns into a tiger and just starts like throwing everything he can at Takamura.
Takamura.
And Takamura just puts him down because, you know, he's a heavyweight and yeah. everything. And it's like, that kid's insane. You're like, oh, maybe he's not like
yeah.
Ippo. Like,
maybe they're maybe not the same type.
He's much more vicious. And
yeah, and which he is. Like, he was way, way more vicious. Because the thing about Ippo, which is one of the shonen tropes, is that he's, you know, kind of pure-hearted, you know, gentle. Like, he's still a great fighter. He can still destroy you with one punch. But he's a good person. Whereas Sendo has all this raw power, and he's not like a bad person per se, but he's going in there with the intention to win. Like, he's not going to wait it out. He's not going to wait for Ippo to throw the first punch. Like, he will throw all the punches if it was up to him and not let Ippo throw a single one.
Ippo's there because he wants to test himself and he wants to test boxing and he loves to box.
Yeah.
Sendo's there because he loves to fight.
Yeah.
And everything.
Like, like, he was a Saiyan in another life.
Pretty much, like yeah. I think Sendo was Fit Finley, like he.
Yeah, I love Sendo's character, if only because he's one of those few characters that after all the fallout that happened between this fight and the second fight where they went fought for the championship, you know, they had that great moment at the end with the Dempsey roll and all that. He's still Ippo's friend. Like, after all was said and done, he holds no real grudge that I've seen in however many chapters of the manga. We're what, a 1,000 chapters? 1,200 chapters, maybe?
We're nearing 1,100 now.
Okay, we're nearing 1,100, and this happened, you know, very, very early on. This is like, what, not even in the first 100?
Yeah, I think this fight was like 75 or so, and right, then their so, second fight was so around like 200, 300.
Yeah, they're still friends. Like, there's no bad blood between them that I know of, so...
No, they're still friends. I mean, he still wants to fight Ippo again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Ippo still wants to fight Sendo again.
Yeah, get the rubber match.
Pretty much the only person Ippo never wants to fight again is Mashiba.
Yeah, because Mashiba scares the crap out of him.
Mashiba scares the crap out of me. But
yeah, but I think Mashiba at this point, like, if Ippo were to fight him after he's fought so many different people, and, you know, I can't remember the name of the fighter that did the rope trick, the disappearing one. I can't remember his name.
Oh, are you talking about the magician?
The one who disappeared, quote-unquote, in the ring, but he was just using the rope.
Oh, you're talking about Wooly.
Wooly, yeah. And, like, after fighting people like that, I think Mashiba will be whatever. Like,
Well, I mean
he's still scary, but
he's leveled up for sure, and I mean he's IPBF champion. But right. I mean we're kind of varying off and talking more about just Ippo as a series in general.
Yeah.
But focusing just purely on the fight, this was the one where you get to see that Sendo is known as the Rocky of Naniwa. He's known as Kansai's Rocky, and
mm-hmm.
And so these people are always celebrating. They're treating him like he's Rocky Balboa, but he actually like goes into like this express thing. He's like, I love that they call me that, and I know why they're calling me that is because of Rocky Balboa,
yeah.
From those movies. But my hero is Rocky Marciano, like the undefeated heavyweight boxing champion and everything. Like I want to be like that Rocky, and.
Which goes to show, like, the knowledge of the author, you know, of boxing. And, you know, that his characters also, some of them, very knowledgeable of boxing. Especially, you know, the coaches and whatnot. Like, I think Ippo's kind of like us. You know, like, he wants to understand boxing. He wants to like boxing. But, you know, he doesn't have all the knowledge. And all these people he meet, you know, give him that knowledge. And especially, you know, fights like this, you know, he gains that knowledge when it's beaten into him, too.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, okay, well, this doesn't work, so now I just have to get to where I'm gonna, he throws this angled punch, like, if I can get the angle going right and everything, you see him, like, slowly trying to get this punch right, and then he finally connects it, and it's like, oh, snap, busted him in the jaw.
Yeah.
But, Sendo rushes in so ferociously in this fight, and he's dominating Ippo. And
mm-hmm.
and Ippo like clips him back with one big punch, and they kind of get into this smash off where Ippo's throwing this compacted diagonal upper, but it's still a straight and everything.
Yeah.
Whereas Sendo's throwing his jagged smash punch, and they're trading these punches and everything. All of them KO blows, but they're just forcing themselves through it.
Yeah.
And you get to this point where like Ippo's just overwhelmed, and he's like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get up. Like, he's going to knock me out at the beginning of the next round. And just before the bell rings, he throws this right, and he hits him right in the temple. And Sendo no-sells it. Like, he doesn't react at all. Like,
yeah. He's
just been punched in the side of the head, and he's just staring daggers at Ippo. And he walks back to his corner and sits down, and he's still staring at Ippo. And you just get this thing, like Ippo's done. Like, he's going to lose. Like, he's just staring daggers. This guy just took a shot to the temple and no-sold it.
Yeah, like one of his hardest punches, because I think he even mentions, like, that punch had put a lot of weight in it. Like, I know that how hard that punch was. And Sendo, again, like you said, he no-sells it. Like, he's just sitting there like, whatever. Like, yeah. Doesn't say anything about it.
And he sits down, he's staring these daggers at Ippo, and then the bell rings, Ippo gets up, barely, terrified,
Sendo
starts walking over, and Sendo's still sitting in the corner.
Yeah, like he was on autopilot.
Completely was just running on nothing but adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he had to sit down, he
couldn't
went unconscious, still staring at daggers at him. And and it gave you this. I mean, Ippo's obviously was influenced by the first big boxing manga of all time, Champion Joe, Ashita no Joe, and.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fight that ended exactly like that, except Joe murdered his opponent in the ring. Like, the guy died from that shot. Sendo, you know, survived and ended up having another cool fight and everything afterwards. But, like, you have several episodes after that where Ippo's like, he was staring at me and I knew I couldn't beat him, and then he didn't get up. Like, I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
And so that ending moment just forever sticks with me, that it's just so crazy. Because that's kind of like something you could see happening even.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm pretty sure that's happened. I mean, I can't think of an example right off, like, on the top of my head, but I'm sure it's happened. Like, I'm sure someone has gotten punched to the point where they were still in the match, but then they went sit down and couldn't get up afterwards. Like, I'm sure that has happened.
Oh, lots of boxing matches have ended with the guy not able to get up after the round. It's just like the way that he was just still staring forward, like unconscious with his eyes open. Like,
yeah, yeah,
sticks with me.
Yeah, and kind of giving Ippo that look, like, I'm still here.
I'm still
that, here. That was the thing that got me. Like he had like that glare on him. Like, I'm still here. Like, I'm not done.
Tiger.
The Rocky.
Rocky of Naniwa. Yeah. Number six.
Numero seis. No.
Bledo. Evil. We're talking about Tekkaman Blade.
Tekkaman Blade. Oh my God! This is the one where they go around the planet, isn't it?
Around the entire planet.
Okay.
Multiple times.
Before you start like explaining this fight, because you know Tekkaman is more of your show than it is mine. But the thing, because I saw this, you know, when you mentioned it, and I was like, okay, let me watch the fight and see how it fares. Like, where would I rate it? And before you explain it, this is a fight that spans the planet. Like, that's how long they fight and how vicious and crazy it is. Like, that it spans the entirety of planet Earth.
And the entirety of the episode.
Yeah.
The entire episode is that fight.
Yeah, 30 minutes.
Yeah, and this is a 1980s anime. Like, this entire fight was hand-drawn, frame-by-frame cell animation, and it's gorgeous. It's to this day gorgeous.
Yeah, like, I could tell it was older, but I didn't think it was 80s. It didn't look that old.
It was drawn with such a shine and quality to it. And it's such a big moment for the series, because, like, a lot of tropes, like, for anime, we're kind of born with this, like the evil brother brainwashed by the organization and everything. Check. It's like, yeah. the final transformation in the big battle. Check. The enemy has the same transformation as me. Check. It's like,
yeah.
Superpowered flight around the world. Check. Like, my girlfriend might die in this fight. Check. The world's in peril. Check. Like,
check.
Like, everything in this fight. But it was, you know, kind of one of the originators of it, and it's just so ferocious. You have Blade, who grew up and his family was on a space mission. They were abducted by aliens and implanted with these things called the Radom, and that's what turned them into the Technomans. And Blade was the only one saved from that group and everything. And so he was able to escape, and he shot towards Earth, and he's like, these aliens are coming. They're going to take over Earth. I have to get there first. But his ship was slower, so the aliens had already begun to take over the planet. And so every single time Blade kills one of these enemy Technomen, he's killing one of his family or one of his, you know, close family friends that were on the ship with him. So it's just a really dark image for the entire series being painted in that light.
Right.
And it culminates with him fighting his twin brother, Tekkaman Evil, in English known as Technoman Saber.
Now is Evil the bad guy?
Yes. Evil's the bad guy.
Silly I'm question, sure, but that's one of those things, like, when you told me the, you know, what the fight was, you're like, oh, Blade versus Evil from Tekkaman, and I was like, Evil's the bad guy, like.
you're like, so Blade is fighting, like, figuratively Evil?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought I was going to get, like, some devil type thing. I was like, wait, the dude's name is Evil? Like, all right.
Yeah. I actually kind of prefer the English renaming.
Yeah.
Saber.
Mm-hmm. Because Saber's a little more, it,
like, the equal of,
yeah,
of Blade. It was kind of like Blade and Saber.
It's more yin-yang than it is like Blade versus bad guy. Like, he might as well be.
I mean, not to mention that they're twins. I mean,
yeah, exactly. So, why was his name be Evil? Like,
I mean, a lot of the Technomen had strange names in the original Japanese. I mean, there's Technoman Evil. I think there was Technoman Dead. They were all just like destruction and death and everything, except for the couple that were like gun, sword, axe.
It's kind of like the problem Star Wars gets with Darth. Like, anyone who's called Darth anything, you're like, you're a bad guy, you're a Sith. Like, yeah. Like, sorry, like, I can't trust you.
Yeah, exactly. But this fight had built up everything. I mean, Evil has been built as this unstoppable creature, and He's built up and he's taken this rare transformation that he's going to become into blaster mode. And so Blade has to do the same thing. And what happens when he enters blaster mode is every single time he transforms into a Technoman, he is going to lose less and less of his memories to where like he'll be a mindless husk by the time he's done fighting. Yeah. And so as he's killing his own brother, he's killing his memories of life. And the only way to get to the final station and kill the Redam Master is to get Evil's Tech-Setter crystal along with his own. He'd need the powers of two crystal to fly through space. But as they're battling each other, they're flying around the entire planet. You already talked about this. And you see this point where, like, cell by cell, they're slashing at each other with their blades as their bursters are flying around the sky. And, like, you see it. You see, like, the desert in the Middle East. And then you see, like, New York City, like, devastated in war. And then you see, like, the coasts. And then you see the, like, they're just going round and round the planet as, like, the sun is, like, in different stages.
Like I said, when I saw that part of the fight was where it got me. I was like, this is kind of, like, a big, epic, you know, big fight. I mean,
big fight feel in this.
Yeah, it doesn't get any bigger than fighting across, like, the entirety of the planet, just flying across the entire planet Earth while still fighting and just wreaking havoc wherever they went.
And it culminates with them shooting into the sky and landing on the orbital ring, because one of the big things of the series is there's an orbital ring around the planet that allows you to kind of, like, loop and shoot up. They fly up to the orbital ring, so they're, you know, in the upper stratosphere in space, and they go into this airlock area and they finally do the final strike. And the time limit ends for Blade, because Blade can only fight for 30 minutes. If he goes past 30 minutes, the Radom Tech Setter system will destroy his mind and he'll become evil. So right when his buzzer goes off that, like, the time limit's up, Saber's about to stab him, he stops because he wants to win on his own. And he allows Blade to, you know, de-transform, spend his last time, you know, resetting, and then they're going to fight again anew. And so they do this reset, they go in, he powers up again, they go into their final mode, slash into each other, he kills his brother, he kills Techoman Evil finally. And you get this moment where he falls forward, and out of the back of Techoman Evil's suit, this crab bursts out, and that's the crab that was implanted in him years ago.
Right.
When he was and that's the last memory before all of Blade's memories are wiped from his mind from the transformation. Is the last thing he sees is this thing coming out, and it just ends with him stomping this crab into goo, screaming, "My brother, my brother, my brother," like with tears streaming down his eyes. And it's just this powerful moment. And then the last thing he knows is he has to pick up the crystal, shoot up to space, and die fighting the final warrior. There's just so much emotion going through this fight and so much, like, beautiful action that
I think it's what we were talking about earlier, how there's a fight can be good, like, it can be well animated, it can be well choreographed, but when you have an emotional attachment to it, when you have, like, two brothers basically fighting, and again, with the stakes being raised, it makes it a better fight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you have anything extra that you remember from this fight?
Not for that. Again, I wasn't a big Techoman fight, and, you know, I only seen, like, bits and pieces, but when you told me about the fight, I had to look at it. And I've seen the fight, like, about, like, 10 times after you told me, if only because of the one part where they're just streaking, they start streaking through the planet. And I'm like, are they gonna fly across the planet while fighting? And lo and behold, like, that's exactly what they start doing.
Yeah, that's how huge this fight was.
Yeah. Like, it spanned the entirety of planet Earth for them to get to each other.
Number five, Captain Gundam versus Commander Sazabi of the Dark Axis SD Gundam Force.
What's this? Another Gundam?
No. Another Gundam series. The SD Gundam is like the kiddie Gundam.
Yes.
The entire series was about these chibi Gundams, and these aren't your regular Gundams. So
yeah, regular
Gundam are these towering giant robot mechs.
That look humanoid.
That have, you know, humanoid shape, but they're battle jackets. They're like the size of a skyscraper almost.
Mm-hmm.
These Gundams are the same size as children. These are like these are like 4 or 5 foot Gundams.
Yeah, they're pretty harmless, quote unquote, like, you know, compared to a regular size Gundam.
And so Captain Gundam is the Gundam from Neotopia, and he is the head of security basically for that planet. And that planet's been marked by this evil corporation called the Dark Axis, who goes through different dimensions and conquers worlds. And they have, you know, this big army of smaller robots, and then they have, you know, commander robots and stuff. And they're being led by Commander Sazabi, which is, you know, a really powerful one. And it's ultimately a comedy show, but this fight has this mixture of comedy and silliness while
serious
still,
business
while still being just so hardcore, like an arm is broken and his eye is shot out and all sorts
it kinda,
of
yeah it kind of reminded me this fight like you said, there is, you know, it's like kits basically, you know, kit Gundams, and it's there's the humor and whatnot, but it reminds me of We talked about this before, where the Trunks versus Goten during the tournament in Dragon Ball, where it was a fight between two kids, and, you know, it started like, oh, it's just two Saiyan kids fighting, whatever, and then it just kept escalating.
And then it was like,
escalating. And then it became
the best fight.
Like, yeah, then it became like a very real fight that you're like, oh my god, wait a minute, like, this is a really good fight. And they're taking this extremely seriously.
Exactly, and it's kind of funny because you're walking this weird line where it's like, okay, well, there are these little robots, but they pack a big punch.
Right.
But, like, it's comedy, it's still silly, and, like, there's a little boy with, like, anti-gravity roller skates, and he's able to just, like, skate around the thing. But at the same time, this fight is at a point where, like, it's very much, like, if he dies, the world ends. Like, they're gonna take the world.
Yeah.
So it's playing both ends of the cards, but you never really think about it, and so it has both feelings going at the same time, and it's one of the few cases where it pulls off both equally well.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite moment is before this fight even starts. Captain Gundam has this catchphrase that he always says to the enemies right before it begins and everything, like basically like his cop speech and everything. And he jumps in, the final boss drops down, Commander Sazabi drops down, he jumps in, lands in front of him, points the gun, and he says, like, I have been granted special dispensations in defense of Neotopia, Dark Axis, surrender at once, and everything, mm-hmm. and the episode ends, like, with him pointing, and he says, like, surrender, and you're like, the hero's here, the hero is here, and then the next episode starts, and obviously, he doesn't surrender. The fight begins, and they go through. And you see that Captain Gundam has taken the wheel pack from Gunbike. He has taken the wings from Gunwing, and he's taken the armor packs from the Gundivers. So he's got, like, all of the powers of the other ones, like, inside of him.
Nice.
And Zero, the Winged Knight, gives him the dragon emblem, and Ashimaru, I think is his name, gives him, like, the samurai spirit, like, at the same time. So, like, they're doing that, like, Dragon Ball-esque, like, give you the power, like Passover. And
Right.
And they run in, they, like, punching each other, they punch each other's arms, like, the arm blows up, and, like, he's got a broken arm dangling at his side looking like Gohan at the end of the Cell games.
Oh, yeah.
He's chasing him around, shooting these, like, lasers out of his eyes, and Captain Gundam's, like, shooting back, and he shoots into the eyes, and he blows out each one of his eyes. And at first you're going like, that's pretty cool. But then Ken Mander says off, he's like, stop doing that. And you're like, that's pretty funny. Like, like that he's reacting like with annoyance rather than like, ah, my eyes.
Like, bro, your eye. Like, you should be worried about
and everything. He's, instead, he's like, stop doing that. Like, it's just really comical keeping through it.
Yeah.
I just really enjoy that fight. It was just so much fun.
Again, I have no real attachment to, like, the Gundam series. So I saw this after you had mentioned it, you know, for the list. And pretty good fight. Like, again, it just threw me off, like, how it skirts that line of, like, is this comedy or is this serious? You know, just going back to that example of Goten and Trunks, where it just sort of, it plays with comedy and seriousness for a long time, and then it just commits to, like, okay, like, now we're serious.
Mm-hmm.
We're still keeping a little bit of that humor.
And it keeps that kind of, like, trope of, like, the enemy is just like me, because there's that moment right at the end, Captain Gundam's finishing move is he does the windmill with his arm, mm-hmm. and waves it around really, really fast, and then delivers like a huge punch to punch through his chest. But yeah. As he's like winding up for the punch, Captain gets all of his powers from the Matrix inside of his chest. So it's obviously a nod to Transformers with the Matrix of Leadership.
Yeah.
But you see that Commander Sazabi has a Matrix just like him, and he says, like, yeah, I'm just like you. And then he punches right through his chest. Like, it's kind of like his last revolt against being evil. And finishes off the Dark Axis, drives him away, and then, you know, it gives, like, a segue for Season 2 to begin. But that big finish is what it's all about. And it's just a really cool, fun fight.
That big finish.
I don't know, like, when you say it's like he punches him, like, it doesn't sound like a big finish, but it's really cool.
It is, though, yeah. Like, it's something, it has to be watched. Like, the punch, it's more than just, like, a punch. Like, if you just imagine a punch, that, yeah, it doesn't work.
Speaking of punches.
Speaking of punches, lots of punches.
Number 4.
Number 4,
Gomu no Gatling!
The sole One Piece fight in this list, because, you know, we can't put too many, we have to put just one per anime, so it was hard for me to pick one from the entire pantheon of fights that occur in One Piece. But we settled for Luffy versus Crocodile, Monkey D. Luffy versus Sir Crocodile, the warlord.
Sir Crocodile, the former warlord of the Seven Seas, bounty, yeah. 81 million berries.
Nice, a whole bio for him. the Sansan fruit user, eh?
Now refresh me, the Sansan fruit user against the Gum Gum fruit user. Refresh me, had Luffy had a bounty yet at this point? I don't think he got a bounty until after this, but I could be wrong.
He had a bounty because of the events in Arlong Park. If you remember,
okay.
Arlong had a Navy officer in his service that he was feeding him money, berries, whatever you want to call their bellies, their currency. So when Luffy overthrew Arlong during the Arlong Park arc, this guy got on, you know, called Navy HQ and said, give him a whole bullshit reason to give Luffy a bounty. So he had a small bounty at this time, if I'm not mistaken, because of those events.
So was that when he had the 30 million
bounty? Yeah, because it was very small. It was very small. It wasn't until Crocodile that's when he gained the first big bounty, which was, I think, 100.
Yeah, I think he did 30, 100, and now he's at, like, 400 million.
Yeah, and then there was the one after CP9, which I really had to struggle not putting Luffy versus Lucci as the top fight that I wanted from One Piece, but there's a reason why that fight just didn't make it for me, and I opted for Luffy versus Crocodile. Like, I don't know how you feel about Luffy versus Crocodile.
I like Luffy versus Crocodile a lot. It's one of my favorites. I would definitely put it in my top three for One Piece, but your argument won me over as far as this one being the top one.
Mm-hmm.
My emotion personally goes with Eneru. I just really like that uphill battle against
yeah, yeah.
Literally uphill, or uphill, yeah, I think, stock.
I think Eneru, the only reason it didn't work for me, I mean, I love that Eneru, like, got his, basically his ass kicked by Luffy, since Luffy was the only person that was immune to his powers. I think the only reason why I didn't care for that fight was that Luffy was obviously superior to Eneru, in the sense that Eneru couldn't really control Luffy. Like, he had to try to put all these things on him, to put all these things in the way so that Luffy couldn't get to him. So it was more of a battle of attrition as opposed to it for me.
I like right. the idea that the hero has the advantage, the type advantage, and still struggles to barely be able to pull it off against a villain, rather than the case with Crocodile is Crocodile 100% had everything on Luffy. Like, Luffy,
yeah, exactly.
Luffy, like, couldn't punch him.
Yeah, Luffy, he was his superior in every way.
In every way and everything. And Luffy just had to, through sheer determination, find that weakness and be able to pull it out.
Yeah.
So
and even when
it's
found
very
the
much
weakness.
The exact, they're very opposite fights that they had. But Crocodile definitely had a lot more, like, even though there was a whole group of people that were going to be, like, marked out in genocide, mm-hmm. Crocodile, like, had he won, whole islands, like, are going to be under this Baroque Works banner. Like,
yeah. Yeah, they're and, you know, he was going to try to take over Alabasta. You know, he was going to destroy Kingdom's dynasty. Like, again, going back to the whole political thing, like, I like that he was a villain that had aspirations that weren't just, oh, I want to control the world. Like, and they even mentioned that at one point he wanted to find One Piece, but, you know, the New World sort of chewed him and spit him out.
Well, he wanted to find the One Piece, but Alabasta had the key that he was hoping that he was going to find one of the sacred weapons.
One of the weapons.
Was Pluton supposed to be on that?
It was supposed to be there, and it was one of those things where, he wanted to find the weapon, but it probably wasn't going to do him any good, like, to find One Piece at least. He just wanted to get the weapon at that point. And going back to that, now that I'm thinking about it, the weapon is probably going to be, like, something weird and silly, because they said it wasn't there, but I'm sure that's a lie. And judging from what happened in the Fishman arc, where we found out that the princess was the weapon, I'm sure that's probably going to wind up being the case here. Like, we're going to find out later on that Vivi was probably the weapon or something like that. Like, just mark my words on that one.
Well, I don't think Vivi will be the weapon that was there. I don't know.
I think Karu
the duck,
but Luffy Crocodile,
that duck was legit, man.
Here's why I like this fight. First of all, it's one of the few CP9. Okay, so when Luffy fought Lucci, there was, I guess arguably, there was two rounds. There was the first time he met him and just got his ass kicked, you know, got his ass handed to him, and then the second time where they fought for what it seems like forever. They just fought forever, you know, dragged on and on and on and on. Luffy versus Crocodile had a clear three rounds. Like, the first time they met, Crocodile just dominated him. Like, the power of the sand fruit just... like, Luffy should be dead if it wasn't for Nico Robin saving him. Like, Luffy should have died. Like, One Piece wouldn't have continued if it wasn't for Nico Robin. The second round was when Luffy came flying in, and, you know, he had the water.
Water Luffy?
And, yeah, no, it was, he didn't quite, he understood the water thing because of what had happened in the first fight, but he wanted to test it out. So, yeah, he did the water Luffy, and it was kind of like a silly middle match. Like, you know, he drank all the water, and he was just, like, bloated, and Crocodile was like, are you even taking this seriously? And they fought, and it wasn't, like, there was all these elements. Like,
that's,
you know,
the
one
where the second round's where Crocodile grabs him and does the water drain on him, right?
Right, he does the water drain, and then Luffy can just, like, grow it back because of the water he was drinking.
Yeah, it splashed down on him or whatever.
Yeah, so this was again going back to Captain versus Commander. This is kind of like a silly fight. Like, the first match was, you know, just monstrous. It was just like, this is horrifying. Like, Luffy's dead. Second match was kind of like, oh, this is kind of funny that he found the weakness and now he's making light of it. Third round is where shit gets real. And again, another trope that we've seen in a lot of these fights, we have a time limit. You know, like, there's a bomb that's going to go off. The building they're in is caving in. You know, there's all these things that are happening And there's a sense of desperation during the fight. And Luffy, I know he kind of like has to stop kidding around because this is getting very real. Like, you know, a whole country is about to get overthrown and it potentially explode because, you know, Crocodile had his plan B, so to speak, or plan C, because he had a lot of plans, and he was not just going to let some kid get in his way. Yeah, very much like Shishio. He had all these plans that were happening at the same time. So Luffy had not only to beat him, but he also had to stop everything else that was happening, or at least the trust that his crewmates would take care of it. So there was a lot of writing in this fight. And he finally got him with, I can't remember, they have an argument at the end, and basically, you know, going about how Luffy's too optimistic. He hasn't seen the world. He hasn't seen what the pirate world is going to do to him, what it did to Crocodile. You know, Crocodile talks about how he had aspirations once. He wanted to find the One Piece once. And obviously that didn't happen. Something happened to him that made him jaded, made him become this monster. And Luffy, you know, pretty much tells him, like, I will never be like you. I will surpass you.
That's kind of always the point where you know, like, okay, Luffy's got this guy now.
Yeah,
right when the person admits that they gave up on their dream at some point.
He's like, I'm not giving up on mine.
That's why Bellamy got beaten so quick was Bellamy started the fight and he's like, I don't believe in dreams. It's like one punch, boom, you're done.
Yeah, like was done. Like that is like the running theme of One Piece where it's like, you know, but if you don't have dreams, then Luffy has no time for you. Because exactly. Luffy has the biggest dream, you know, to become the Pirate King. So Luffy just punches him through bedrock. I mean, he punches him from the bottom of the castle.
Why are his punches landing? Because we said before, his punches can't hit sand.
His punches had blood on them. They were blood soaked from his own blood, I believe. I think it was Luffy's blood.
Yeah, he had been fighting so long, he had been cut open during his fights. And
gashed.
He's just punching through with bloody fists.
Yeah, so because his bloods are just filled with blood, and I mean, he's enraged at this point, he punches Crocodile upwards through the ceiling of the bottom of the castle, through the bedrock, and outwards into like 1,000 feet in the air. I don't even know how Crocodile survived that fall, but he did. But, I mean, it was pretty impressive. I don't remember how the manga depicted it, but I know in the anime, they depict it as buildings collapse when he came out of the bedrock. Like, because the earth just, like, split sideways. So I thought, I think that was the first moment that I saw in the show where Luffy's power was just, like, it got to that ridiculous point where I was like, holy hell, what did I just watch? And Crocodile was the first villain to ever really challenge him, because before Crocodile, name one villain that had really beaten Luffy or gotten close to beating him.
Buggy.
What's that?
Buggy.
Buggy. Well, he did have him in a little cage.
No,
but yeah,
in all seriousness, yeah, that fight was just incredible. Before we move on to our next fight, a little side note. Your favorite member of Baroque Works?
My favorite member?
Yeah,
of Baroque Works?
Like Mr. Number, you know, 0 through 20, or Mrs.
You know what? I don't remember the codes, but I really like the guy who could make snot become explosives.
Oh, that was Mr. 5.
Mr. Five, like...
with the booger explosives?
Yeah, like, he would just, like, pick, flick, and it would just explode.
Yeah. Oh, God, that guy cracked me up, too. Yeah. I think my favorite was, I think her name was Mrs. Golden Week.
She was the partner for Mr. Five, wasn't she? The one with the umbrella. Is that who you're talking about?
Was that Mrs. Golden Week? Mrs. Golden Week I'm thinking of was the one who had the painting power. Like, she would paint a certain color.
That's right. The one that...
she was Mr. Three's partner with the candles.
Interestingly enough, she kind of... she reminds me a lot of the current villain in One Piece, the... Sugar. I think it's Sugar. The little girl.
Yeah,
from,
she reminds me a lot of Sugar, too. Yeah,
yeah, like, they have almost a similar power. You know, it's similar. I think it's very similar. Similar design. You know, less creepy, but very similar. Like, the face and everything.
So
You know what? Since you mentioned her, I have to give an honorable mention that one of my favorite fights in the entirety of One Piece is Usopp v. Sugar.
When he shocks her, makes her foam at the mouth.
Because they have this huge, huge thing that, like, they're like, the only way that we can beat Sugar is if we get this poison berry into her mouth and it'll knock her unconscious. Yeah. This Tabasco sauce. And instead, she's KO'd just by Usopp making this weird face.
Yeah. Which I want to see animated, because I want to see, like, what that translates into in animated. Because when it was drawn, it was just a face. Like, I don't know if he's making a sound or if he's making, like, I don't know if he's...
There has to be, like, the funniest sound effect when they get But he makes this face, and she just passes out of sheer terror from this face.
Yeah.
That look at this panel, because this panel's hilarious. And then she wakes up, and she starts, you know, making toy soldier zombies again.
Mm-hmm.
And they shoot this new pellet at her, and you're like, oh, okay, like, this time the plan's gonna work. But the pellet just turns into this flower of Usopp's face again, and she passes out again.
So she's, like, done for life if she sees Usopp. Which reminds me a lot of Perona. The Perona, where he scared her. It wasn't with a face, but, like, he basically, his power is, he's so scared to fight that he's scaring people out of their fights.
Well, like, Usopp's always had this weird thing. Like Perona, she had no effect on him because her power was, it'll make you afraid. Like, the ghosts will make you afraid no matter what. Usopp's already afraid of everything, so it had no effect. But Usopp also has these, like, random power-ups. Like when he beat the holy hell out of the mole lady.
The mole lady. Oh, that's right. Well, that was kind of him and Chopper. Chopper had a lot to do there.
It was the tag team, but, like, it was Usopp whose, like, nose was, like, broken into a lightning bolt and... Like,
that's actually one of my favorite non-epic fights. Like, it was a good fight, like, animated-wise, and the way they did the tag team thing.
It just had that cool tag team aspect and everything.
Yeah, we need more tag team fights.
Upcoming episode, favorite tag teams.
Yeah.
Look out for that one. But, yeah, Usopp and Chopper, as they do that thumbs up to each other, after they take out, I think it was Mr. Four and...
Mm-hmm. The one with the baseball.
And I don't remember her name, but... Yeah, he had the baseball.
Merry Christmas. Miss Merry Christmas.
Yes, Miss Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
But that was just amazing.
Yeah. I actually really enjoyed that. That was probably...
I think that's
that was my third favorite fight there, actually.
I think that's why I think overall, like...
Hmm.
Luffy v. Crocodile, it all coming back. Why that's the best fight is because it was the culmination. It was not only a huge, amazing fight all on its own, but, like, never before had we seen every single one of the Straw Hats have
really good,
arguably
fight.
Their best fight.
In yeah,
because Zoro learning to cut steel was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Nami mastering the elements against Miss Doublefinger was, like, a really cool woman-on-woman fight.
Yeah, and then Sanji had to fight someone who was arguably his equal. Like, because they literally would do the same move to each other.
Yeah, Bone Clay, like, even with his tricks that, like, he couldn't be kicked, he was almost as good as Sanji anyways.
Yeah, so
later on in Impel Down, like, Bone Clay became, you know, a fan favorite with
Impel. Yeah, fan favorite, nice. He became a face.
he did that face turn, man.
Yeah, he did that face turn. Him, Crocodile arguably also did actually, he was more of a tweener, but...
you didn't catch that? Face,
yeah.
Face turn?
Yeah. Eh? Eh? Oh my god. that's good. A lot of people are going to be like, what? I don't get it.
Bone Clay changes faces.
Anyway... But yeah, I think that was, to me, that was the fight. That's probably the fight to show someone who's new to One Piece. Like, that's the one that you should be like, this, you need to watch this arc. If you're not going to be convinced by anything I can tell you, watch the entirety of Alabasta.
Yeah, just that island, and you're set. Like, you're like, where can I get more of this One Piece stuff?
Yeah.
Moving on, the other one of the big animes that just ended.
The big three.
One of the big three, quote unquote, going on in One Piece. We already had Bleach. We just finished One Piece. While we both prefer One Piece more than this series, this fight though. Off the chain.
Yeah, and it doesn't have Naruto or Sasuke in it.
Either of the two main guys. Yeah. Our best fight in all of Naruto, number three, is Rock Lee versus Gaara.
The Chunin Exam. Holy hell.
The Chunin Exam. The tournament saga for Naruto.
Yeah. And they never did have another tournament, huh?
Pretty much without question, you have to say that the Chunin Exam was the peak of Naruto. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was
yeah.
when they had their best theme song with Haruka Kanata. It was when they had their best fights. It was when they
best
had...
best animation. Because when they did that time skip, I don't know what happened. But that animation turned atrocious. And, like, the character design, I don't know if they changed house. Like, I don't know if the animation studio was a different one. But all I know is that Naruto went and had, you know, their heyday. They became Shippuden, and I've never was able to get into it.
Kishimoto, like, his art style kind of changed with the time skip as well. Like, faces became much larger and rounded, rather than that kind of, like, almost sickly, like, small that they had originally.
Mm-hmm.
The faces just became a lot more large.
Yeah.
Everything. But Rock Lee
fight,
Gaara is just pure karate kung fu ultimate action. Because Rock Lee, if you've never heard of Naruto or watched Naruto, Rock Lee is a ninja who cannot do ninjutsu. He cannot do jutsu. Like,
yeah, meaning he can't do illusion techniques or he can't do, like, special techniques. All Rock Lee can do is taijutsu, which is hand-to-hand fighting, which means in the world of ninjas, it means that he has to work twice as hard to be even mediocre compared to everyone else.
Yeah, he can't use magic, he can't use illusions, he can't even use weapons. He pretty much can only fight really, really well. Man, does he fight really, really well. And the person he's facing is Gaara, who has...
Arguably the biggest heel in Naruto outside of Madara, I think.
With the best face turn.
Yeah.
Like, when he eventually did that face turn, you're all like, all right, we've got our new main character.
That's, yeah. We're saved. I was like, we're saved.
Exactly. But when he was a villain, Gaara was a sick, sick man.
A scary guy. Like, his
scary dude.
Like, his main technique was the desert coffin, which basically meant he encased you in sand and not
crushed your body.
Yeah, crushed your body with sand. It's funny that we have Gaara and Crocodile back to back. Since they're essentially the same character.
Sand boys, yeah.
Yeah, they're the same character. I just realized that.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that, actually. But yeah, Gaara had the perfect defense, whereas Rock Lee has only offense.
Yeah.
So it's very much that, you know, like, ultimate spear versus, you know, unbreakable shield. The unstoppable force versus the immovable object.
So the thing about the Rock Lee versus Gaara fight that got to me was not only... So here we have a character who, by all, he's kind of like the Krillin of Naruto, where he's like this guy that's really strong, but, you know, he can never quite catch a break.
Tien.
Or like Tien, he's kind of like Tien.
Sakura is the Krillin.
Yeah.
Sakura is Krillin as shit, man.
But I like Krillin, I don't like Sakura.
I love Sakura. Right? Okay. She is totally Shanaro to me.
So Rock Lee... So Rock Lee has to, like, basically try to win a hand-to-hand combat versus a guy who literally doesn't use his hands at all. He doesn't do any martial arts. Gaara just protects himself with the sand, you know, controls the sand to do his bidding, to strike, to crush, whatever. And the thing that got me in this fight was that Rock Lee's trying, and he's trying his damnedest for about, I want to say, like, 10 minutes. There's the fight where Rock Lee is trying and trying and trying. And he
can't get through it.
Right. He leaves. He kind of like jumps back to this statue and he's staying there and he's kind of like, what am I going to do? And his master gives him the thumbs up and he goes, you can take him off now. Like, it's okay. And Rock Lee's like, I can do it, but you said I can only do that, you know, to protect other people. And he's like, no, you can take him off now. And he takes these weights from his legs and they're like, oh, so he had weights. Okay. But what's that gonna do? He drops the weights from the top of the statue, and they just crash and make a like a crater because of how heavy they are. I mean, there must have been hundreds upon hundreds of pounds of weights, and now he moves like the fucking Flash.
And let's point out, before taking these weights off,
he was fast.
Basically, did a one shot on Sasuke before anybody could see it coming.
Yeah. Like
he was already like the fastest guy.
Yeah,
in the show.
Yeah, the Shunin exam, when it started, they had introduced him, and basically the thing was that he was goofy looking, he only did taijutsu, and he was really fast. Like, they had established that he was the fastest student that was there. But when he took the weights off, it was kind of like, oh my god, he's like superhuman fast. And then the fight took like a whole new dimension. Like, it became like a superhero. It went from like a martial arts fight to a superhero fight in like a span of 3 seconds, I think, when he takes him off and goes in there.
the amount of dust kicked up when he started just shooting all over the place was insane.
Mm-hmm. And he actually got to hit Gaara, I believe. Like, he connected one hit after he did that. Because he was so fast that the sand couldn't keep up to defend Gaara.
Yes. He landed one punch and it struck back and it wasn't when he took off the weights, it was when he did the seal that he did that.
When the punch? I thought, oh, that's right, because he started, are you sure? Because I have a memory of him getting one punch in when he just did the speed. Just one punch, it was only one punch. And then after that, when he did because remember, didn't he break the seal after he did the spinning move? I can't remember the name of the spinning move. Because
he did the big move, and they thought that he landed it, and then it turned out that he only did it to a shell of Gaara.
Right.
Gaara had only been clipped once.
Yeah.
You see that moment where, like, Gaara, like, comes out, like, looking at a psychopath? Because, like, you'd never really seen any emotion on Gaara's face up until this point.
Yeah, he basically no-sold.
Because his entire body is, like, covered in a thin layer of sand.
Yeah, so he can't, like, really emote, because sand is covering him. Hardened sand at that.
So you see this, like, sadistic look on his face after Gaara's taken, you know, the best Rock Lee has, and Rock Lee's body's breaking down, because these seals, as he goes through the seals, put more strain on your body, and I think he does 4 seals.
Yeah, which out of, what, 7, I think?
7 or 8 seals.
Yeah, which basically the more seals you open, the more chances of you dying immediately afterwards it's possible. I think the only person that can open all 8 and not pass out on the spot is Might Guy, the master.
Well, he can, if he opens the 8th gate, he dies, but it was because Naruto gave him, like, magic life.
Oh, that's right.
That he survived.
Yeah.
But
so he should have died.
Should have died. You see him crash through, and then Gaara's going to kill him. Like, he's got him beat, he's down, and Gaara chooses, like, this guy actually hit me. He's the first person to ever hit me. I'm gonna kill him. Like, and all of the instructors, like, every single ninja instructor drops in front of Gaara. And basically what you see is this kid, this Chunin, like, lowest, or this Ganon still, lowest level of all the ninja ranks, has all of these jonin, like, top level ninja ranks in front of him, being like, if you do this, you're fighting all of us, type thing.
Yeah.
And Gaara's still going like, well, let's go, let's do this.
Yeah. like whatever, I got this.
and he finally gets called off, and he doesn't, and then he still snaps Rock Lee's leg and arm.
Yeah.
Crushes every bit of bone in both of them.
Yeah. I remember. And after that, it was kind of like, oh, Rock Lee's not going to be in a fight. And it was one of those really disappointing things, like, oh, man, like, this character who who just, I mean, he just kind of appeared in the tuning exam. He wasn't in the beginning of Naruto. Like, they had never introduced him until, you know, midway through or beginning of tuning exam. And then you have him and you're like, wait, he's done? This is it? But thankfully. Thankfully, he still had another moment under the sun.
Miracle operations, he was able to come back and
Had and he had what I think was the second best fight in Naruto. Like, I'm pretty sure you know which fight that was, but I thought that was like the best fight.
Oh, him and Gaara versus Kimimaro.
No, I like the you're right. Yeah, him and Kimimaro, the bone guy, when he did drunken fighting, absolutely great.
I love that drunken fighting. It was awesome.
Especially the animation.
I have to take my medicine. And it's like,
and it was fucking
didn't
alcohol.
Take his medicine. He took my sake. Like,
they're like, wait, what? So yeah, drunken fighting. I love the Jackie Chan's Drunken Fighter or Drunken Master.
Like, Legend of Drunken Master is one of absolute best.
Yeah, so when they basically did, you know, a drunken like Rock Lee is obviously Bruce Lee, like the way he fights and yelps and whatever.
And
but they
the
gave him the
Rock Lee, like,
yeah, and they gave him the Drunken Master gimmick. I was like, oh, like this is the fusion of my two favorite martial artists.
I think Kishimoto actually admitted that the reason he named him Rock Lee is because he rocks like Bruce Lee.
Right, and then the Drunken Master is obviously a homage to Jackie Chan. So, so there's so a great character, and I was glad that he had another moment. But
homage
his fight with Gaara,
or an homage to Jackie Chun.
Oh, nice.
You did see that Drunken Master from Master Roshi in the
Ball. That's right, yeah, and the fact that he was named Jackie Chun, which they must really love Jackie Chan over there.
As they should.
Yeah, I mean, I know, you know, he's Chinese and they're Japanese, but they really must love the guy.
Well, I mean, he's Jackie Chan. I mean,
yeah, right.
I think everybody loves Jackie Chan. But Rock Lee vs. Gaara, incredible fight, one of the coolest ones in Naruto. Lots of stuff going down with that one. And now moving into number two.
Number two.
Dragon Ball only gets spot number two. Spot number two for Dragon Ball. And that's Goku versus Piccolo Jr., the absolute best fight in all of Dragon Ball.
The last fight in Dragon Ball, correct?
Unless you count that filler arc where they get the Bancho fan.
Right, but and for those listening, like, it's Goku as a child. This is Child Goku Dragon Ball, not Dragon Ball Z.
This
is the first time he fights Piccolo.
This is the first time you actually see Goku relatively as an adult. Goku's 18 in
Is he 18 already? He's
18 in this fight.
I thought he was like 16 or something like that, but okay.
He was 15 when he fought Tien in the in the previous Tenkaichi Budokai.
Right. And, yeah, because there's like, what, 3-4 tournaments?
And there's 3 years. Every 3 years they have a new tournament.
Oh, okay, that's right.
So it's kind of like the Olympics and everything. It's every 3 years instead of every 4. And then he had been training with Kami on Kami's Towers for the entirety of the 3 years after killing King Piccolo. Yeah. And this entire time they knew that the son of Piccolo, like with all of his essence and all of his power from birth, was also training and going to come and, like, at the tournament, it would be Piccolo versus Goku, and they were going to throw down. And all sorts of things tried to get in the way. Like, Krillin did his best in, like, his coolest moment fighting against Piccolo, and he ends up being beaten. Yamcha, you know, faces Kami. He gets, you know, beaten really, really fast because he's Yamcha.
Yeah. Yamcha, why are you useless?
And then Kami tries to beat Piccolo by stealing him in the jar, and Piccolo reverses it and everything. You find out that Piccolo Jr. has mastered the reversal wave of the Mafuba and seals Kami instead.
Yeah. And
what he does is he picks up the jar that has Kami inside of it, he swallows it, and pretty much makes it for certain, like, if you want to beat me, you're going to have to kill me to get Kami out, and that's going to kill Kami. No matter what, Kami's going to die.
It's a lose-lose situation.
The lose-lose situation is the way that he's built this up. And meanwhile, like, Goku's building up his own thing, and you see Goku as an adult for the first time, like that more recognizable Goku and everything.
Yeah, know? Yeah. And, the bulkier one, you know.
And he's already taken off the weights when he fought Tien earlier, so like it's Goku at his best versus Piccolo at his best. And this is the fight where it made that turn. Because they had fireballs from early on in Dragon Ball when he learned the Kamehameha.
Yeah, yeah. And some characters, you know, had like a beam technique of sorts, like Tien had the triangle or, you know, yeah. Like they had established that they could do that, but they had never abused it until this fight. And before the Goku versus Piccolo fight, most of the fights tended to be semi slapstick, even when they were serious. Like even when Goku fought I always forget his name. He has the ponytail, he's dressed like, you know, Japanese garb, and he has like the mustache. I forget his name. But even, and you know, he was kind of serious.
Oh,
you know,
you're talking about Crane Master?
Yeah, the Crane Master. Like, even when he fought
Oh, no,
him,
you're talking about Tao Pai Pai.
Tao Pai Pai, there you go.
Yeah,
Tao Pai Pai. Like, even when he fought Tao Pai Pai, like, there was still a little bit of slapstick in their fights.
Yeah, because
like,
Tao Pai Pai would, you know, pull a tree out of the ground and throw it and then surf on the tree. And
right, and like, yeah. You know, if he got shot with a Kamehameha, like, he would sell it like a cartoon would. He wouldn't suffer it. He'd just be like, oh, you know, he would have the hair burned up and all that. Like, it was very slapstick.
That fight even ended with, he jumps in the air, he throws the grenade. Goku kicks the grenade, and it's like, no!
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's very slapstick, whereas Goku versus Piccolo, this is when it turned into... This is why there's two different anime. There's Dragon Ball Z.
This fight is bloody...
And brutal, yeah.
Like,
yeah, this is a pretty gnarly fight for Dragon Ball standards.
We all knew from later on in Dragon Ball Z... Because the majority of us watched Z and then went back to Dragon Ball because, for whatever reason, that's how they gave it to us in America.
Yeah, yeah. We never got to enjoy Dragon Ball when it was aired.
So we knew, like, just a piece, like, Goku or Piccolo can grow back his arm because Raditz cuts off Piccolo's arm in Z and Piccolo just, like, shoots a new arm out.
Mm-hmm.
In this fight, in Dragon Ball, there's this point where Piccolo is throwing a fireball, and it's chasing Goku. It's, like, seeking him. And Goku runs right up to Piccolo's face and jukes to the side. And so Piccolo, like, puts his arm up and blocks his own blast.
Yeah.
And you see his arm just dripping with blood, like, ripped open.
Mm-hmm.
And Piccolo grabs it and rips it off. And it's, like, you see the muscle tearing.
Yeah.
Like, just really gross. The entire crowd, like, reacts in shock. And then he grows a new arm that's still covered in blood. Like, this fight is bloody.
Yeah. And it's just, it was a really, like, barbaric fight. Like, again, even for Dragon Ball standards, like, you could tell that Toriyama went from, I'm going to make this story about, you know, like, kind of like a parody of Journey to the West, or like, his own version of Journey to the West, and make it whimsical and funny and have these characters, you know, that... At the end of the day, it was kind of like a comedy. It was an adventure comedy. But when he gets to Goku Piccolo, it becomes an action martial arts sci-fi. You know, especially since they start establishing, like, Piccolo. I think they had established Piccolo was from outer space, right? Or were they still selling him as someone from hell?
He was the Demon King.
He was still the Demon King. So it wasn't until the Saiyans came that they just started establishing, like, okay, these are aliens. But yeah, like, the ending of Dragon Ball, this being, like, the ending of Dragon Ball proper, you know, was just a crazy fight. And, like, it bled into, no pun intended, bled into, you know, Dragon Ball Z, where it was more action and more barbaric fights and more decapitations and, you know, arms falling off and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and this fight also, you get to see the most of Piccolo's abilities. Like, you'd see him a little bit throughout Z, but...
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, and this one, he throws everything.
Piccolo has the stretching arms like Dalzim from Street Fighter, and he's shooting him out like whips.
Yeah.
You see that Piccolo can go into giant form.
Yeah, Piccolo, oh, that's right.
Giant in the middle of the ring, and is mashing down, like, beating the hell out of Goku. And Goku is able to break out, and this is how he saves Kami. He's able to break out while Piccolo's giant form does a reverse Kamehameha, propels himself into Piccolo's mouth and body, comes out, climbs out with the jar, and saves Kami. Like, absolutely crazy. He pulls him out. And then he's standing there and, you know, he forces him to shrink down. He does the big finger flip. Mm-hmm. Like, he grabs Piccolo by the finger and karate flips him over with just his finger.
Yeah.
Piccolo shrink down, blast like crazy. He hadn't invented the special beam cannon yet, so you didn't see that one. But.
Special beam cannon! Also, yeah, like, longest Japanese name ever. Like, I didn't realize what's the... Well, no, the have you read the...
Oh,
the translation?
Like what that means?
Yeah, oh my god, it's so long.
It's like, devil's piercing, immolating light of doom or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah, something light gun, yeah. It's like, it has the word demon in it, though, so, man. Absolutely ridiculously
long. But, yeah, Goku vs. Piccolo, they go out at pure balls to the wall action, ferocious and amazing, and the perfect ending to Dragon Ball.
Now, what could possibly cap Goku vs. Piccolo, though?
I'll tell you what could cap Goku vs. Piccolo in Dragon Ball.
What's that?
An entirely different anime in Dragon Ball Z. Goku versus Majin Vegeta as the best fight in all
of this is our fucking list, so we're going to do this as is. Technically two separate animes, like technically two different themes going on. One was whimsical, one was balls-to-the-wall action. But both have Goku as the top fights. Goku versus Piccolo, as great of a fight that is, like, has nothing, and I mean nothing, on Goku versus Majin Vegeta.
Yeah, Goku versus Majin Vegeta is the fight, the rematch everybody was waiting for.
Like, yeah.
Everybody wanted to see Goku and Vegeta fight one more time. Everybody still wants to see
them fight again, yeah. Like, they're...
Like, go around three, since Goku won the first one. Well, actually, Goku won both.
No, that's right. Yeah.
In all reality, like...
Well, Goku won... Oh, wait, no, that's right. Vegeta knocks Goku out to go deal with Majin Buu, you're right.
Yeah, because Vegeta defeated Goku with his Uzaru form in the first fight. Yeah. And then the Majin Vegeta, he does the trick and he knocks out Goku and, you know, wins asterisk or whatever. Like,
yeah, yeah.
We all know Goku was holding back Super Saiyan 3, so Goku could have won.
Yeah, so you could argue, we'll put an asterisk, like, Goku should have won during the Majin Vegeta fight if he had taken it seriously.
Yeah, and
he did take it seriously the first time, and in the first one, he did lose against Vegeta. Like, just pure loss. Like, the only reason that Vegeta was, you know, climbing out and trying to leave was because, you know, Jajiroba took his tail. Krillin
landed on him?
Yeah, and wasn't Krillin... Yeah, Gohan landed on him, and didn't Krillin attempt him to kill him?
Like, well, Gohan landed on him while being a giant ape, and it smashed the last of Vegeta's energy.
Right.
So he's crawling away, and Krillin, with all of his energy left, had Yajirobe's sword, and he was gonna stab.
Oh, that's right, he was gonna stab him, which would have been weird.
Yeah, exactly. And so, Goku screamed at him that he had to stop, and he had to let Vegeta live, because
as a true Jedi.
Vegeta again.
Yeah. Goku is a Jedi, just letting you know right now.
Well, I mean, the Force is key. I mean,
the Force is strong with Goku.
But
yeah, that fight, arguably, I mean, you could say that Dragon Ball Z is the story of Goku and Vegeta. Like, from the beginning, you have Goku has his journey, Vegeta also has his journey. Like, he is definitely the secondary character in this. Like, yeah, he started as a villain, but you see him grow alongside Goku, and up until the very end. Like, I mean, all the way till the Buu saga, when he finally admits, like, you know, Goku, you're better. Like, you're the better man, the better fighter, you know. He finally admits that, and that's when you finally get, like, the arc closing on his story. It's still, like, his story as well. Like,
he still very much has the rivalry with Goku even after that point.
Exactly, yeah. Like,
there's still a lot of that in there. And here's the thing. Vegeta is my favorite character of all time.
I think a lot of people would argue
most people's. At least in North America.
Oh yeah.
There have been a number of polls for the favorite Dragon Ball character, and Vegeta has come out number one by like a landslide.
Like in Japan, Goku always wins, but that's because they like their good guys to be, you know, the pure heart good guy.
Well, whereas Four Star, who's doing Dragon Ball Z Abridged, has said that like Vegeta's like their way most popular character. Like,
oh no, yeah, like there's no going around it. Like Vegeta's just such a good character because he has layers to him. Like you can see why he is the way he is. Like with Goku, it's kind of like you just accepted that he's pure-hearted because that's just the trope. But Vegeta is like a full-fledged character. I mean, this is a guy who was prepared to commit genocide. Actually, he committed genocide. Thoroughly, multiple times in different planets, you know, comes to Earth, gets his ass handed to him, gets to see Goku beat the guy who has had him sort of like imprisoned, you know, enslaved all this time, and he had to do what he told him, Frieza. And then after that, it's kind of like, okay, I can chill with this guy, you know, like I still want to beat him, but I can chill with him. Then he gets married with a human, and you know, he sees things that he didn't see before. Like there's character growth. Vegeta has the most character growth out of any character in Dragon Ball, I think, even more so than Goku. Like more character, like he goes from one end of the spectrum to a completely different
person. I would say Vegeta and Piccolo both have the most character growth.
Yeah, Piccolo as well. I mean, Piccolo, he's still kind of a hard ass, just like Vegeta, but I think Piccolo, the only thing that could have changed him. Well, no, you're right. Cause he also became kind of like one with Kami and wanted to protect the Earth. So yeah, there's those up there too.
I mean, there was just a lot of character development in that time where he was training Gohan.
Yeah, when he became like a father figure and all that, which was really strange. Like, cause as we discussed in the number two,
your worst enemy.
Yeah, the worst. Child. Yeah. And he trusted him too. He's like, yeah, like, okay.
He's like,
do
he's
it.
Like, hey, Piccolo, take my kid.
And then everyone was kind of like,
It's like, wait, like you have a wife. Like, we can just send your kid home to, no, take my kid. Take him.
Train him, please.
Train him. Make him strong. Yeah. I hate that kid.
That's funny.
No, but
Majin Vegeta.
But Goku versus Majin Vegeta specifically was the rematch everybody was waiting for. It had a lot of parallel points. I mean, probably like the most emblematic image of the entire series is the point where Goku and Vegeta throw a punch at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And connect with each other's faces. Like, just that cross punch. Absolutely awesome. But, I mean, you have Vegeta, you know, threatening the crowd. He does that big blast through the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
They fight each other in the wilderness and everything. He pins him. Vegeta does this thing. You never see this before, but
and you never see it after.
You see that they can use their ki for their energy blasts to form
rings,
like shapes and stuff. Like before, it was just like you could do a pulsing beam or you could do like a cutting disc.
Yeah.
But Vegeta shoots out five rings. They connect and clasp around Goku's legs, arms, and neck, and pin him to the wall. And then he tightens them so that they're like cutting into his body. He walks over, he pretty much works
him.
Goku over, and then he slaps him in the face and everything, mocking him. And Goku powers up, breaks his arms out, and has two giant boulders on his fists.
Mm-hmm. And then beats him with
wrecks
it.
Him in the face, shattering these boulders on his face. Amazing shot right there.
Yeah,
like
that was probably that one, the punch, the two of them punching each other. I like that spot. I like the spot that you just described. But I also, the one that I like the most is because Goku doesn't want to fight Vegeta, even though Vegeta completely let himself be Majin'd, possessed by Babidi. So he wanted this fight. Vegeta wanted this fight, and he wanted to get like a power up, so to speak, to make it even better for himself to fight Goku.
Ultimately,
Goku doesn't want to fight.
They kind of revealed that Vegeta didn't get much from the Majin boost.
From the Majin, yeah, no. There wasn't much. There was
a
little bit.
His power didn't change. It just kind of released his commissions and gave him an excuse to fight.
He wasn't even. He even says he's not even in full control because he tells Babidi tells him do this and he's like, no, I don't have to do that. Like, you only have me slightly under control, but you don't have me completely under your control. So I like when he goads Goku into it, and I mean, he pretty much holds the tournament grounds hostage, and Goku's looking at him like, you're not gonna do this. Like, you saved the Earth during the Cell games with me. Like, you have a kid here. You know, you have Trunks. Like, you're not gonna do this. And Vegeta, without even, I don't think he announces it, like, he just extends his arm to the side, and the animation in this episode is amazing, like, which I think helps this moment, that they have the best animators. He extends his arm and shoots the crowd and leaves. I mean, there's hundreds of people that just died, like, and right there, in an instant. What's
really powerful about that shot is the crater is right next to his wife.
Yeah. So he shot the general direction of Goku's wife. And at that point, Goku is just infuriated, turns Super Saiyan. And now you have both of them for the first time as Super Saiyans looking at each other about to fight. Because remember, before that, they had fought Kaioken and regular Vegeta. There had never been a confrontation between them as Super Saiyans.
Full force as Super Saiyans. And what's really good and is with, you get that reverse because Vegeta shot the crowd and then said, like, I'll do it again. I will shoot the crowd and kill more people if you don't fight me.
Yeah.
And when Goku's pissed and he does that, the Supreme Kai kind of says, don't do this fight. It's what Babidi wants. And you have Goku put his hand in the Supreme Kai's face saying, I'll kill God, because I'm going to fight this motherfucker right now.
Yeah, like, I think that's the first time Goku, I mean, you've seen him mad before, like, especially when Frieza killed Krillin and he absolutely lost it. But I think this was the second time where you saw him mad, and you saw him mad at himself and the person that he was fighting. Like, I think he was more mad with himself for letting it escalate to this point.
Very true.
So I really like, and again, like, the animation, I see, this particular fight is probably the fight I see the most. Like, I've watched this fight a million times.
Oh, this whole fight has incredible animation. I mean, there's even that point where Vegeta throws a punch, Goku catches his fist, and then Goku throws a punch, and Vegeta catches his fist. So they're holding each other's fists.
Yep,
and the knees. they do a couple knees, and then they lock against each other, and they throw headbutts.
Yeah.
And they do, like, six headbutts on each other, just standing there, just boom, boom.
And
boom.
The headbutts create, like, this energy forces every time they hit each other, and exactly. they start bleeding. Like,
they're
even
bleeding
the
from, they're just busting each other in the face with headbutts as they're standing there. It's insane, like, how badly both these guys want it, and they're just crushing on each other.
Yeah. So yeah,
there's many great moments in this.
Yeah,
fight.
I was gonna say, like, Goku versus Majin Vegeta, like, by itself could be an episode of the podcast. So
it even has, like, my favorite combination technique. Vegeta punches Goku in the face, and then after he crosses back, he comes back and elbows him in the back of the neck, knees him in the stomach, and then throws him down to the ground. Like,
yeah, I know. Yeah. And again, the animation, just great. I think that's another thing that worked for this fight. Like, it was a good fight to begin with. Like, this could have been put anywhere, and they could have had the shittiest animators. It still would have been a great fight. The fact that they had their top animators at the time doing this helped tremendously.
Absolutely. But yeah, that's the best fight in all of animation.
Them shonen.
Them shonen. Shonen me the money.
That's probably what Toriyama's saying nowadays. Jeez.
Pretty much. I cannot wait for that next Dragon Ball fight.
Oh man, that next Dragon Ball
Frieza
movie. Yeah.
I'm all about that Beerus fight too. That Beerus fight's amazing.
There you go.
Dragon Ball Z, like we said before, like Dragon Ball got one, Dragon Ball Z got one. If you don't like it, tough. Dragon Ball Z honestly could have been all of the top 10.
It really could have. Like, I had to fight the impulse to put Goku versus Cell, Gohan versus Cell, Majin Buu, Kid Buu versus Super Saiyan 3 Goku, Kid Buu versus, or Super Buu versus Gohan. Like, there's a whole bunch of fights I could have put here.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to our top 10 favorite fights. Tons of great ones all throughout there. If you have any favorite fights that you want to let us know about, you can tweet us at Straw Hat Rican and at Cyan of Flame. As always, thank you for joining us. I am Cyan of Flame.
And I'm Straw Hat Rican.
Have a good night.
Good night.